You know, this is, excuse me, a damn fine cup of coffee.
I don't need you to tell me how good my coffee is, okay?
Hello and welcome to another damn fine cup of culture. I'm once again here with my friend Julie.
Hi.
And we're joined by a new guest star for this month, namely Sam. Hello, Sam.
Hi, everybody.
So to begin with, perhaps tell us everything about yourself.
Well, what's there to say? I'm currently a middle school teacher at a distance, as we all know, because of the current crisis situation. I teach English and history, but I'm also a project guy. Like, I do plays at school that I stage. I do movie retrospectives and book clubs. And because of the current situation, I've also become a YouTuber recently, mostly because of my students. I do like introductory videos for them. But then I also started my own videos about movies and records recently. And I guess I've been a film buff ever since I was 12 years old. One night when my parents kind of prohibited me from watching a James Bond movie because they said it was really bad. And then I watched it and really loved it. And that was the start of it all. And since then, I've become really interested in Hitchcock and Woody Allen, in Polanski movies, the really problematic directors, you know, but also Bergman, David Lynch. And I'm also a really big fan of like disaster movies and Italian giallis, those thrillers from the 1970s. And I guess most of all, I'm a fan of movie soundtracks, which I collect and really appreciate. This is my first venture into the world of podcasts. So I'm really excited and a little bit nervous, but I'm looking forward to this.
You definitely have no reason to be nervous. I mean, after your introduction, I basically feel a bit inadequate almost. What is your YouTube channel in case anyone wants to check it out?
It's called Sam Goes on Record. And what I do is I normally pick like 10 favorites among my, you know, record collection and guilty pleasure movies and favorite movies. And it's still in development. So some parts were quite good, I thought, and some parts really amateurish. So I'm still working on this. I'm still learning.
Okay, that sounds very cool. We will later on be talking about one of the greats of American cinema, but we are going to keep you in suspense just for the moment. As always, let's just see what have we been watching, listening to, reading, playing, what kind of expressive dance have we seen on Zoom, probably. Let's perhaps start with Julie. What have you been up to culture-wise?
Well, I've found a very interesting new bio, which I started reading. It's called Without Lying Down by Carrie Beauchamp, and it's about Frances Marion. And anybody who now says who is completely right. She was one of the most famous scenario writers in Hollywood, but she's been sort of kind of forgotten a little bit, which is really a shame because it goes into this really early era in Hollywood before the moguls moved in and pushed everybody out. So you have all these wonderful women doing directing, doing scenario writing, doing everything, and nobody's heard about them. So I was really fascinated by that. It's a great read.
It sounds very good. These days we have so much time to read, so I'm definitely going to note that one down. What about you, Sam? What have you been checking out culture-wise?
Well, you're absolutely right about having so much time to, you know, to watch and read. So I've had quite a few things I was able to read and watch. Maybe just in connection to what Julie said about script writing, I watched that miniseries Hollywood on Netflix, which deals with, post-World War II Hollywood scene and where everybody tries to get into becoming an actor, actress, or then a script writer, director. And I thought that was very well done up until maybe the second out of five episodes, where there's a really fresh take on alternative history. And then it turned into like, I don't know, a kitschy version of how it should have been told from the perspective of today, where, you know, everybody who was LGBTQ suddenly got accepted and they won Oscars. And I felt it was a bit of a cheap way of telling people back in the 40s, you know, you should have done it differently. It would have been so easy. So especially with regard to Rock Hudson, who's one of the main characters. And I guess we all know he's not had an easy life as a Hollywood star and being gay in the 50s. Mm. So, yeah, I thought it started promisingly, but then turned into something very, very wrong in the end.
Yeah, it sounds interesting, but I think alternative history or kind of rewriting history is tricky. It's very tricky. I think we talked a bit about that when we talked about Quentin Tarantino last year.
Absolutely. I was reminded of Quentin Tarantino's Inglourious Basterds, and I thought he did it so brilliantly in that movie because it was obviously a kind of a joke or an obvious alternative version that didn't happen. But yeah. With Hollywood, if you watch it, you're never quite sure if it's, you know, for people who are not so informed, you think, well, maybe that's the way it was. And I think that's really dangerous. It's kind of revisionist.
Yeah, it's absolutely off. I agree with you. Yeah, I had the same exact same thing.
Okay. I'm afraid I, out of morbid curiosity last night, I watched Justice League, and let's just leave it at that and never mention it again, please, okay? But I've also watched some better things. And I think a couple of months ago, Julie wrote a rearview mirror on our blog about Jean Renoir's The Rules of the Game. Mm-hmm. So we watched that one last weekend. Takes a bit to get into it, but I really enjoyed it in the end. And we also watched Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, which I'd never seen before. I mean, I'd seen films from that era, obviously, but not that one. And it was great fun. And I was just amazed at how raunchy it is, how dirty the jokes are. But also at the same time, it's basically the dirty jokes come from the women. And they have so much agency, sexual agency, which I just didn't expect from a film from the, it's, what is it, late 50s, right?
I would think so, yeah.
So it's one of those films where you think in some ways it's decades before its time. So I really, really enjoyed that one.
And maybe on that note, Matt, if you look at a movie like that, how they were able to avoid censorship, you know, by doing that, mm-hmm. by writing clever dialogue that was kind of risque, I guess, but they got away with it. That was kind of their way of being more open, more direct in the 50s. Mm-hmm. Not like they say in Hollywood, you have to behave like it's 2020.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they even use Technicolor to kind of circumvent censorship. I mean, there's this one scene where one of the two female leads is basically, she's surrounded by all these athlete sportsmen, and they wear these ridiculous bathing trunks that are basically a skin tone. So at a first glance, you're wondering, are they naked? Yeah, I was actually quite flabbergasted. I was sometimes almost stuck between laughing and just sitting there with my mouth wide open that they could do that back then, but they do it with great panache. So definitely anyone who hasn't seen the film, it's very well worth checking out. It's not one of those where you have to kind of watch it with footnotes to get what is going on. I think it still very much speaks and sings and chuckles dirtily. As I've said before, we are going to be talking about one of the greats of Hollywood cinema. We have touched upon this director before last year when we had our Summer of Psychopaths. But I'm actually going to hand over to Sam here because he has brought something very, very nice for us. What have you brought us, Sam?
I have brought us an alternative look at Alfred Hitchcock. And we've given a title for it, The Good, the Bad, and Alfred Hitchcock. So we want to have a look at characters in Hitchcock movies and especially how we relate to them and specifically also how we relate to characters that might be perceived as evil or bad or questionable. But I wanted to kind of get you started by taking one of the titles of a Dario Argento movie from 2005, which is called Do You Like Hitchcock? And I wanted to ask the two of you, first of all, why do you love Hitchcock movies? What's the thing that makes you enthusiastic about that particular director's movies?
For me, it's absolutely the imagery. Because of Hitchcock's famous American movies, and I'm thinking about, for instance, Psycho and so on, we tend to forget that he started in the silent era. And this focus on imagery is so strong throughout his entire body of work. And that is what keeps me coming back. Even if it's the movie is problematic, that's what keeps me coming back. I mean, these images are so strong and some of these shots are so technically brilliant that even if you don't like the movie, there's still something worth looking at in there. So that's my sort of favorite thing about Hitchcock.
And what about you, Matt? Why do you love Hitchcock?
I think there's definitely a lot of overlap there with what Julie just said. I think he is an amazing stylist. He always has been. His mise-en-scene is absolutely iconic. It's exciting. It's exhilarating. It's just fun to see how he uses film to tell his stories. One thing that I think is also very important, I think Hitchcock always surrounded himself with fantastic collaborators. I'm thinking of, for instance, composer Bernard Herrmann, Saul Bass for many of the titles, obviously the actors that he keeps returning to. I think Hitchcock is one of those directors that many have tried to imitate, but very few have actually managed with anything where you could say, yeah, that's worthy of saying it's Hitchcock-esque. I kind of like Hitchcock best as, I would say, almost the essential pop art, you know, in the 50s, early 60s, the films he did then. I can take or leave the later ones, and also to a lesser extent, the very early ones, possibly also because I don't know them enough, so it might be ignorance speaking here. But I think especially around 55, 60, I just love what Hitchcock does around that time. How about you?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of overlap there as well with the two of you. I just thought basically Hitchcock is film school for life. That was my first reaction. You learn everything from Hitchcock. You know, the way he writes or prepares his scripts or co-writes them very often, the way he manipulates the audience, then how the way he builds suspense, of course, how he plans a sequence. And then, as you said, how he uses music or how he has his collaborators work on camera perspective, music, everything is almost perfect with Hitchcock. And then the other thing, you know, the variety of Hitchcock's work, starting in the 1920s in the silent movie era, very much influenced by German expressionism. But then he goes on up until the 1970s and almost does a new Hollywood experimental thing at the end when he does Frenzy and Family Plot, movies like that. And then, of course, I love his dark sense of humor and sometimes the very grim outlook he has on the world, which becomes, I think, stronger throughout his career. And at the same time, even down to very small roles and sometimes even extras, it's all brilliantly selected, entertaining, exciting. His movies still work fantastically. I've tried it with a couple of students and Psycho, and they still go nuts at the end of Psycho because he's such a great manipulator.
Do students these days, do they know beforehand what the twist is? Because when I first saw Psycho, I'd heard someone, you know, you've seen the parodies, you've seen the jokes. Are students these days, again, at a point where they're actually surprised by what happens?
They are surprised. I was surprised myself to find that out because they tend to know the, you know, famous shower scene. They know that someone gets killed in the shower. But then they don't follow up on that, what follows after. And I think that's what the great manipulation about Psycho is. You kind of know the shower scene as an iconic one, but who knows exactly what happens afterwards? The fans do, of course. But the movie takes so many twists and turns that in the end, I was excited to see it again this time because the way suspense is built until the very end. So now that we have our perspectives on why we love Hitchcock, I wanted to focus with you today on characters rather than favorite movies, because I think we could have easily done, you know, what's your favorite Hitchcock movie, but we wanted to focus on character more. So let me ask you what your favorite Hitchcock character is, if you have a thing like that.
I had like such heartache trying to pick one, but I think my favorite character is from Rebecca and is Mrs. Danvers. Not because I particularly relate to her or because I think she's a nice person, but she sort of fascinates me. She's probably one of the scariest people in the Hitchcock films I've seen, and that's saying something. I mean, she's still scares me. Of course, the great gothic set piece of a movie, Rebecca, which helps with the big scene at the end with her burning down the house. I mean, I think she's just magnificent. And I think she's also often overlooked, I think, because Rebecca is a pretty atypical Hitchcock movie. So I picked her because the acting on that is also so sublime. I mean, and she is so mean and cruel and nasty and obsessed and just really wonderful, wonderful stuff.
Yeah, great choice, I have to say. What about you, Matt? What's your favorite? Do you find one?
I'm afraid that my choice is probably going to be a bit more boring because I couldn't really choose. I have to admit that, I mean, I find the topic absolutely fascinating, but I sometimes find it difficult to separate Hitchcock's characters from his actors, especially in the films around 55, 60. I think he very much uses iconic actors and uses them very much in an iconic way. Sometimes I think he's the one who created these almost iconic characters for some of these actors, the Cary Grants, the Jimmy Stewarts. I think so many of the main characters from Rear Window, Vertigo, North by Northwest, Psycho, I think when I think of these actors, I think of these characters and vice versa. And I mean, I do think that the acting is always very good, but there's also a certain kind of, I mentioned pop art before, and I think there's sometimes an almost comic book quality to how he uses characters, very kind of primary colors, broad strokes, but in order to achieve an effect. And I think also very often the characters are made by the situations they're placed in. You know, I know what Roger Thornhill reacts like when he's pursued by a crop duster. I don't necessarily know what he's like when he's at work. I don't need to know that. I think the characters and situations are so entangled.
Absolutely. And to your point, I mean, if you look at that era that you mentioned, 55 to 60, and especially Cary Grant and James Stewart in their iconic roles, I had the same impression. It's basically Cary Grant playing Cary Grant, if you look at North by Northwest. Very high. That's that feeling very strongly. But then also he uses sometimes the technique to turn or to manipulate the audience. If you think of Vertigo, James uh-huh. Stewart, who is such a likable actor, played so many likable roles. But then if you look at Scotty Ferguson in Vertigo, he's not a likable character. What he does in the end, he becomes so obsessed. And I think we still identify with him, but at the same time, we know he's questionable. And I think that's the suspense he creates with characters uh-huh. very often. He makes us like them, but then they do the most horrific things at certain times.
Uh-huh.
I also had difficulty. I related to so many of them, especially because they sometimes fail at, you know, restoring order to get back their identity, to fight their inner demons. So I think we can all relate to that as kind of a human experience. I picked James Stewart's character in Rear Window, actually, because with him, I feel we're really sitting there in that wheelchair and we're watching all the neighbors, and he is us. He is the audience, and he at the same time has this struggle figuring out whether he wants to get married to beautiful Grace Kelly. So I love this conflict that he's in between curiosity and watching all these failed and successful stories playing out in front of him, but then at the same time having this woman, this wonderful, perfect woman that he doesn't know what to do with. So that's the character I most related to when I was thinking about all the characters that I've seen.
I think Rear Window is actually a perfect film for these times. I mean, in some ways, it's almost like, I don't know, webcam view or Zoom, and you've got all of these windows and different stories. It's perfect. And as you said, I mean, I think he definitely puts us exactly in the seat of the main character.
And if you think of the fact that at the time he was starting his television career, and I've just started watching, you know, the Alfred Hitchcock Presents series as well. It's basically the mix of cinema and this television work. So every window is somewhat an episode from Alfred Hitchcock Presents, if you want. So that's what I found fascinating rewatching it. Anyway, I think with Hitchcock, we have many iconic characters, but then we also have character types. If we had to do a list of like typical Hitchcock characters, what were the first three that would come to your mind?
The first thing that I, and this is going to sound like post-mortem psychoanalysis, but the first thing that comes to mind with Hitchcock's films is himself, right? So he almost casts himself via Jimmy Stewart or via Cary Grant. And these two conflicted men are either wicked, obsessive, troubled, dark, blah, or they're these beautiful, romantic, wonderful hero types, right? So it's almost like it's two parts of Hitchcock's fantasy about masculinity, maybe about himself. I know when we talk about Hitchcock, we often talk about his women. But to me, what sort of comes out most is the men that he portrays, right? Because they link so directly to his wish fulfillment. If you look at, for instance, Notorious, where he gets to make endless love to the beautiful Ingrid Bergman, right? This is total dude wish fulfillment to me. And then on the other hand, he's so fearless about looking into obsession in Vertigo, which is again, Jimmy Stewart. So the Stewart Grant dichotomy there, I think is really, really interesting. And of course, obviously, always, everybody's always conflicted. All the baddies are always conflicted, or they have some psychology wrong with them, or they're completely bonkers or obsessed, but they're always conflicted. That's what makes his baddies so particularly interesting. I mean, these are this is the trifecta to me of what Hitchcock sort of does in the period that we're talking about today.
And you, Matt, if you had to name the top three Hitchcock characters, what would be the first to come to mind?
Difficult to follow that answer that Julie gave, which I think was a really, really nice one. I mean, I think of kind of the Hitchcock cliches almost, the pursued innocent, the one that didn't do it, but somehow has to clear their name. Then obviously the kind of icy, chilly blondes who are an object of desire, a potential threat, a potential love interest, all of this kind of mixed into one. And obviously the voyeur. I mean, you mentioned Rear Window before, and I think Hitchcock's films are nothing if not voyeuristic, and they are totally self-aware about exactly that element. I mean, there's, I think, a lot of kink in Hitchcock, and it expresses itself especially through voyeurism. And I would definitely agree there that there's definitely a thematic overlap, a vast thematic overlap between the characters and Hitchcock as director, Hitchcock as the one who can shape these characters, can shape these narratives, and Freud would have loved Hitchcock.
And of course, vice versa. if you look at all the Freudian stuff going on in Hitchcock. You'd already pretty much did the perfect list, because those are also the top three that I had, kind of the angelic, dangerous, deceiving women, the innocent, guilty, obsessed men, and the evil, likable villains, and also henchmen. So I'm going to just add a couple, because I thought they were relevant for the three movies that we focused on for today. There's very often also the loving or overbearing mothers. And I think, you know, we've watched the mother of the mother films as well for today. And then I always thought there were also like side characters that very often appear. For instance, the sinister policeman, sometimes almost like a more like a figure than an actual character. And they trigger something in the characters, mostly feelings of guilt, of course. And then also the people who turn against the characters, who first seem to be friends, but then turn into foes in the course of the film. And I think especially with regard to his innocent men films, that's very prevalent, this changing of characters in the course of the movie. But those are more minor characters, I thought. The most important ones you've already mentioned perfectly. So if I listen to that list of characters, there seem to be quite a few unlikable characters in Hitchcock's movies, kind of conflicted characters that we identify with. So we have characters like, you know, murderers or tormentors or criminals, very questionable characters. How does he make us like them? You know, what's the strategy that Hitchcock uses, or why do we end up liking these characters even if we know that we shouldn't? Have you noticed any methods, any strategies that Hitchcock uses to do this, to accomplish this?
Yeah, you cast Cary Grant in anything, and you're going to always love him. No, that's a cheap shot. But it's so much is achieved through casting, isn't it? Because as you already said, rightly so, casting Jimmy Stewart completely against type. That has been done previously, I think, in The Thin Man somewhere. He ends up being the killer, but it's not, you know, the most usual. So you always think, okay, this is the guy that I am supposed to be rooting for, right? Because it's Jimmy Stewart. And of course, he manipulates us and then flips that completely around and makes you wonder all throughout. For instance, Vertigo. What is he doing? There's something wrong with this guy, right? So casting, I think that casting against type and the way that people are actually framed and shot is the way that he codes his characters. We're going to get into this a little bit later, but the way he codes Ingrid Bergman, for instance, in Notorious, is sort of very ambivalent. Is she a total slut? Is she the complete Galatea ideal? And so I think casting has a lot to do with it. He was always very, very nasty about his actor. He called them cattle. But I think he needed them more than he wanted to admit during his lifetime. I think a lot of it is done via framing and the actors that actually make us like them, despite everything.
Let's keep the cattle commentary at the back of our minds to come back to maybe later, because that's a famous thing that we accuse Hitchcock of. And I'll be interested to hear from you guys after talking about our three examples, if that holds true, if the characters are mainly figures in his chess play and he moves them around, or if we actually have great characters and people that we identify with. What about you, Matt? How do you find yourself liking unlikable characters?
I think there's two elements here, apart from what Julia's already said. I think one of these elements is that very often the scripts are very, very witty, very funny, very enjoyable. And I think it's easier to enjoy characters doing horrible things if it's fun to watch them and fun to listen to them. I think in some ways, some of the characters that we'll be talking about later on, you know, they prefigure, let's say, someone like Alan Rickman later in his villain roles, where it's just you almost root for them because they're more fun sometimes than the good guys, or at least as much fun as the good guys. And that is in the spark and the wit of the dialogue very often. I think there's also another element that I think we might get into later on, and that's we've got some characters who are, for instance, they are possibly communists, traitors, Nazis, but I think Hitchcock is never really all that interested in that aspect. He's not that interested in the ideology. So we're told that this guy is a Nazi, so therefore he's obviously the villain. But you don't get any of that in the film. He leaves those kind of elements out. he kind of establishes why someone is a villain because of, you know, a label stuck to their forehead. But other than that label stuck to their forehead, in a way, it doesn't matter. And I think that may also makes it easier to kind of like a Nazi or a communist or a traitor.
Absolutely. And also Feltis makes him so multidimensional. If you find yourself liking the, you know, basically the villain most of all in the movie, then you're obviously being manipulated by Hitchcock, and these labels are somewhat overcome. Yeah, I was thinking of just a couple of scenes in Hitchcock's films that perfectly manipulate this, that we like someone, or we at least root for someone, even though they're horrible murders. And one was the scene from Frenzy, you know, where the necktie murderer gets into a potato truck because he has found out that the woman he's murdered still holds his tie pin in her hands. And in a way, the scene is funny and really, really horrible if you think about it at the same time. But then we still root for him to make sure that he gets this pin out somehow. And the other one, of course, is in one of the movies that we'll talk about later on in Psycho. But we can come back to this later, where we somehow root for the character of Norman Bates as well, even though we know that something's definitely wrong with him. So maybe that's a good moment to switch over to the three films that we selected for today's podcast. And I think we all went by a movie that we love by Hitchcock, but where we also found characters that we wanted to think about in terms of why we like them, even though they might be evil or ambivalent characters. Julie, your choice was Notorious.
Yes.
The 1946 Hitchcock movie starring Ingmar Bergman and Cary Grant. So maybe you could tell us a little bit how you observed this in terms of Notorious. What does Hitchcock do there? Who are the main characters? And what makes you like them, especially the questionable ones?
Well, Notorious, let's give a quick intro about the movie. The spy thriller plot is a cheap excuse to have a love story. And the love story is the most important bit. And the two most famous bits in Notorious are two very long shots. One is where Cary Grant and Ingrid Bergman are kissing endlessly, and the camera even follows them into the room as if you're part of this lovemaking thing. And the wonderful shot that goes all the way down a staircase to focus on Ingrid Bergman's hands. But again, the plot is not the point, because Hitchcock didn't care about it very much either. It's about this love story. And the character of Ingrid Bergman particularly is interesting in this story because of how she's coded. You meet her slobbering drunk, a midriff-bearing dress on, and she's hair up, and she's obviously coded as some sort of tramp, right? Her dad is a complete Nazi. But then we find out, after a very long take in which she drunk drives and commits all sorts of stupid acts, we find out through her hangover that she's actually distanced herself from her dad and actually goes against him in a lot of ways, which is when Cary Grant tries to enlist her to spy on Nazis in Rio. Why Rio? We don't know, but it just looks really awesome. Okay. So, and this is where we start with the menage a trois, because it turns out that somebody she's known for a long time, played by Claude Rains, he is a leader, or one of the leaders in a Nazi conspiracy to something to do with uranium, and he has always been in love with her. So the powers that be come up with this plan that she should marry him and spy on him from the inside. And Claude Rains also has this really domineering mother, who is also part of the Nazi conspiracy. And Cary Grant and Ingrid Bergman are in love, but Ingrid Bergman marries him anyway for duty, you know, for the country and for lots of abstract important stuff. And then at the end, Cary Grant has to save her because she gets found out and then slowly poisoned via her coffee. And this is interesting because, again, we always talk about women in Hitchcock and how they are sort of made to be Galateas, how he wants to shape them, how he wants to, you know, completely control them. And this is one of these movies where he's really very clever with the coding of a woman in a movie. Because usually in a movie, if somebody is quote-unquote the tramp, you don't get to walk away from that, right? And Bergman is redeemed by her love for this Cary Grant character. And this is an interesting coding, because you would think that she's some sort of villainous person, but she ends up being one of the bravest people in the film. And the second villain is also poor Claude Rains, who is just completely controlled by his mother. They have these wonderful bickering sessions that you have to see to, you know, to believe. where his mother is completely jealous of him getting married to a young wife. And in the end, of course, he loses. And it's implied that he loses his life also because, well, the baddie has to be punished, right? So it's a very interesting movie in terms of coding and in terms of subtext and in terms of characters. And I think it's also an outlier because I think, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, this is one of the first real adult love stories that Hitchcock put his mind to. And I think he's never done it better since, with the way that the characters are detailed, the way the dialogue works, the way that they are so ambivalent about one another and about themselves. So this inner conflict thing. So that's why I picked this movie. That's what made it so very interesting. I think also because it was a collaboration with Ben Hecht, who also did Spellbound, it has this humanity. It has a little bit of warmth that some of Hitchcock's later pictures really lack. So I think it's an interesting one because it doesn't quite adhere to what we think of as the Hitchcock picture, right? So that's why I ruled this one.
I completely agree with you, Juliet. This is the one Hitchcock, even among the three that we watched, that was the most involving and touching in terms of the character's story and the character's path they took in this film. And I was, you know, you focused more on Ingrid Bergman's character, but I thought that a similar thing was going on with the two male characters as well, where you have Cary Grant at the beginning being completely unlikable and manipulative and blackmailing and unsure about what he wants, and then thinks this woman is really the tramp that she's shown as at the beginning. And then slowly we realize that it's actually his struggle as well, figuring out that she is a good, loyal character, that she really isn't cheating on him, and that she really has true feelings for him as well. And so what I found interesting watching it this time was that we are presented with Cary Grant as a very sinister character, you know, this opening shot of him at the party where we only see his dark silhouette. And then he's called Devlin, you know, kind of a devilish name. And we don't like him for most of the movie until the point at the end where he realizes something is wrong with Ingrid Bergman, and he goes to the mansion and he finds her in the bedroom, and then suddenly he changes. And you find out that it was really his inner conflict of, what should I do with this woman? I really love her, but she seems to be on the other side. And she seems to be still the alcoholic that I met at the beginning. That we start liking him and seeing that we misunderstood him too.
Yeah.
So it's fascinating to see those two characters and what is being done with them throughout the film in the script.
I mean, I agree with a lot of what the two of you've said, but I watched the film with my wife, and I think she just throughout 90% of the film wanted to throw things at Devlin, at the Cary Grant character. I think it's amazing to use Cary Grant as the film uses him, because he is also very charmless for much of the film. And I mean, that's basically, it's a contradiction in terms, a charmless Cary Grant. That's just, it doesn't compute. I have to say, I find it interesting, but also a bit difficult to watch the film from a present day perspective, especially because of Ingrid Bergman's coding. I think that abstractly, I'm aware that she's coded as a tramp and a hussy, but from a modern day perspective, I don't think modern day audiences would ever feel that there's anything negative about that. She reacts like a normal human being would. Her dad was a Nazi collaborator. He's just been sentenced to life in prison. I think she comes across as someone in a very difficult situation. And I think in present day cinema, someone in a difficult situation, if they get drunk, if they act out, that's just, you know, par for the course. Everyone does that. You don't have the same kind of expectations of, you know, angelic virtue that you might have. And in that respect, I find it very difficult to say to what extent does the film want us actually to buy into this view of the Bergman character as a Jezebel, as a hussy. If it does, I think it's something that got lost a bit watching it later. But at the same time, I think you can watch it as it's a very modern performance and a very modern way of writing the character. That stuff that back then would have been coded as negative isn't actually. I think, you know, for me, the villains of the piece for a long time were actually more the, is it CIA? Which one of the alphabet soup organizations is it? I don't
know. One of them. Yeah. The organization.
In that respect, I think it's also Devlin, who feels much more villainous for much of the film. And yes, you get the impression he cares for this woman, but at the same time, you get the impression that he, in order to use her better, he acts cruelly. And I think that cruelty is there much more in him than it is in the nominal antagonist, the Claude Rains character, who has much more pathos, I think.
Absolutely. I actually ended up liking Alex Sebastian the most throughout the film. I thought he was the most honest character in a way because he truly had feelings for Ingrid Bergman. He really was tricked into her loving him, and he was the most gallant and friendly towards her until the point when he realized that she was betraying him. And then, of course, he bonds again with his mother that he's very antagonistic towards for parts of the film. Mm-hmm. And then he of course, is disappointed, but we still feel for him because he really was cheated into loving this woman. And after this scene at the party with the wine cellar, he's really genuinely hurt, I think. Mm-hmm. And what I find astounding is that even at the end, the final image of the film is not Ingrid Bergman, Cary Grant driving off, but it's Sebastian going back into the house where he knows he will face the consequences of his betrayal of his collaborators, his Nazi collaborators. Mm-hmm. So the final thing is this door and him walking up. So I almost felt Hitchcock was ending with Sebastian's fate rather than the happy lovers driving off.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And it is interesting in retrospect, I think, because the way that this story started, I won't go into this in detail, but it was this total Galatea story where somebody is being formed and shaped to be a Mata Hari. But this is what it ended up being. So I think it's interesting that got changed so much. And it has such human characters that we don't see very much in this sort of era, and in Hitchcock in this sort of era. So I don't know whether to blame Ben Hecht for making Ingrid Bergman so sympathetic. I don't know if I should take her coding that seriously. You were right about that, Matt. I took that as a given. It might not be a given, even at that time. And I agree with Sam that poor Claude Rains is just, has been completely suckered. And probably faces very dire consequences because he was suckered for his actual love, for his good feelings towards this woman. Yeah, it's very interesting.
And he lets them escape at the end because of these feelings for Ingrid Bergman.
Yeah.
You know, he walks down the stairs and he knows about the political consequences for him, but he lets them go somehow. He would like to escape with them, but then, of course, they just leave him there. They abandon him. what a cruel fate. To your point, Julie, maybe the fact that it was written as a woman's picture, I read somewhere, so that this was supposed to be a big picture for Ingrid Bergman as a star. And it also seems to have been the happiest collaboration between Bergman and Hitchcock. So that would make absolute sense to say she is not supposed to be the evil character for most of the movie. That's maybe why this bit got lost after the initial few scenes.
Yeah, that was also why it was bought by RKO. It started like a Selznick picture. But Selznick was in trouble, and RKO would love a prestige picture with the star on the rise, Ingrid Bergman, right? So that's why they bought the property. So yeah, you're absolutely right about that.
I had one question about Cary Grant, because we said before he's cast against type in this movie. But if you watch Suspicion, you know, the movie that he did a few years earlier with Hitchcock, he's also this questionable character. So I was almost tempted to ask, what is the archetypical Cary Grant character? Is he the light romantic one of the later movies, you know, past North by Northwest until his very last movies? Or is he really this sinister, dark character that he was in the first two Hitchcock collaborations?
Yeah, I think he signals wish fulfillment. In Hitchcock's films, every time Cary Grant enters center stage, it's some sort of wish fulfillment. I don't know if it's Hitchcock's or a male wish fulfillment, but that's what you see. It's always this guy that gets, even though he's not a very nice guy, but he gets this sort of wish fulfillment fantasy thrust upon him. I think that's Cary Grant's role. And that goes for both. It goes for both the adventure type, where you get to kiss Ava Marie Saint and flirt with her in trains, or get to kiss Ingrid Bergman for what feels like half an hour. But he is the one that signals wish fulfillment, whatever his character is like. I think that's the reason for casting him. And of course, they worked very well together. But I think that's his sort of role in Hitchcock's oeuvre.
I mean, there's also the thing that I would agree that to some extent, my image of Cary Grant is shaped by watching the later films first. So kind of watching his oeuvre backwards. And then, of course, you know, it feels odd that Notorious cast him against the grain when that isn't actually the case so much in Hitchcock. You mentioned that. But this is Suspicious, right? At the same time, though, I mean, he did the romantic comedies earlier in his career as well. So I think that is also what people see, romantic, although often also kind of goofy, witty, funny, but also sometimes the butt of the joke. So I do think that Hitchcock did cast him against the grain a bit.
Maybe that would be a good moment to switch over to your film, Matt, that you selected, because of course there we have, at least on the surface, the complete opposite of Cary Grant's casting, where he really starts a new phase in his career as this, you know, funny slash romantic lead. You watch North by Northwest and focused on characters there. So any parallels to Notorious, or is it the complete contrast, or what can you tell us?
There are lots of parallels, but I think it's one of those compare and contrast things. I mean, to begin with, I think North by Northwest in some ways is the essential Hitchcock film in terms of the scenes that we have, in terms of the characters that we have. It is also, I think, more immediately frivolous and fluffy and just pure fun than some of his other films. I think the darkness that you have in some of Hitchcock that you associate with it is barely there. I would even say that the film is not even suspenseful in a traditional way, because it's a ride more. I think it is one of the most purely entertaining films that I know. I think it's one of the best rides that cinema has had to offer throughout its existence.
That's so funny, Matt, that you mentioned that about the ride. I wrote down in my notes about 10 times the wild ride continues.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's literally, this movie is a full-on wild ride for 2 hours and something.
It is, for as much for its main character, its protagonist, as for us. I think the setup in some ways is very similar to Notorious. You also have this triangle. You've got Roger Thornhill, played by Cary Grant, he's the archetypical innocent who's framed for a murder he didn't commit. He's basically, the bad guys think he's this agent who doesn't actually exist. The agent is a fabrication by, again, one of those alphabet soup organizations. It's a Cold War in this case. It's not post-war Nazis versus good American patriots. You have a constellation where you've got Cary Grant on one side as the good guy. You've got James Mason as, in some ways, the parallel to the Claude Rains character. And you've got a woman in between who may be a double agent, triple agent, whose allegiances are not clear until about halfway into the film. But I would say North by Northwest, it's a case of, you know, history repeating itself first as tragedy, that's Notorious, then as farce, that would be North by Northwest. Farce is perhaps the wrong word, but it's basically, it takes the same kind of patterns, but turns it into something, I think, where there's much more just pure enjoyment, even in the bad guys. I mean, it's where Notorious is the thriller drama, North by Northwest is almost an action comedy before action comedies existed. James Mason, who plays Philip Van Damme, he's the supposed lover of Eve Kendall, played by Eva Marie Saint. And he's clearly the villain of the piece, but I think he rarely seems threatening in a way that actually scares us, the audience. He's almost in some ways a panto villain, perhaps, and he's mostly fun. I mean, there's this weird thing going on where both James Mason and Cary Grant are versions of an archetype. They're both the suave Brits. Neither of them is really a typical image of masculinity. I think there's an element of camp here. I wouldn't say that there's necessarily an element of homoeroticism, but I think there is always a weird flirtation going on from James Mason's side, which I think is then emphasized by, you've got Martin Landau as Leonard, the sidekick, and I think he is very much homosexually coded. And James Mason's character actually seems perfectly okay with that. You know, he is almost flattered that Leonard is jealous of his relationship with Eva Marie Saint. I think, like Sebastian, like the Claude Rains character in Notorious, Mason rarely seems actively evil. We know he's supposedly evil because he's on the other side of the Cold War. And yes, once he's betrayed, he quickly says, okay, we have to get rid of this problem, this woman, by dropping it from a great height, which is, of course, villainous. But it doesn't feel scary in that sense. It's again, it's what I said earlier, it's the fun kind of villain. I think the Cold War plot is more of a MacGuffin. Hitchcock is not interested in geopolitics, I think. He's not interested in ideologies. He's interested in making this film entertaining. And where Sebastian has a certain pathos and drama, I don't think Mason does. I think there's very little in the way of pathos or sentiment in North by Northwest, because in some ways it would get in the way of the ride. Perhaps to quickly get back to this unconventional masculinity thing, because I think it also ties into the villainous thing. I don't think Mason is ever villainous for not being the traditional rugged man. Cary Grant himself is not the traditional rugged man. I mean, he's totally, if you look at the scenes with his mother, I mean, it's weird that in some ways the Cary Grant character there takes over some elements of the Claude Rains character, but it's constantly played for comedy, how this overbearing mother basically, I mean, this man, his closest relationship to woman is with his mother. It's also when he first meets Eve Kendall, I was surprised. I mean, I've seen the film several times, but I couldn't remember just how much Eve Kendall, even Marie Saint, she's the active one in the flirtation. He reacts. Of course, he's, you know, he's escaping and everything. He's trying to save his skin. So you understand that he's reactive. But it's basically, it's the woman who pursues the man. And it's then also weird if you, when you see them kissing. I mean, they're sexy scenes, but they're also awkward scenes. It's like, Cary Grant doesn't know what to do with his hands. He doesn't know how to, you know, it's like he once saw someone kissing a woman, but he doesn't quite know how it works himself. So you've got this weird mirroring between the antagonist and the protagonist, who are both not traditional males. And I think Hitchcock very often had these men who are basically defined more by their wits and by the banter than by anything physical. But if you look at, for instance, something like Marnie later on, where you've got Sean Connery playing very much a much more traditionally male character, in some ways off-puttingly male. So it's interesting how you've got this. As I said, I think I would use the word camp entertainment ride in North by Northwest. That also colors the whole who's good, who's bad, and how does it play into it. The one character who has some complexity in all of this is definitely, again, the woman in the middle, who has to kind of play both sides, who has to do things that she doesn't want to do, who has a job, a mission, and she has her feelings, and those are in constant conflict. So I think if there is pathos in the film, it's there with Eva Marie Saint.
Right. I don't know how you've felt about it, Julie, but I totally agree with that assessment of the fluffiness and the camp of that movie. That's really at the forefront. And I felt much, much less involved with that film. And it's strange because I've seen it so many times, and it's the one Hitchcock that's somewhat perfect on so many levels. And it's kind of like a best of Hitchcock scenes and characters. Everything seems to be in place. I also read that he was working with all his, you know, favorite collaborators at the time, with his favorite editor and cinematographer and composer and so on. And Cary Grant, of course, coming back to do this film. But I feel so uninvolved apart from the fun ride that I'm on. I enjoy the fun ride, but I never really get involved with these characters. Quite contrary to Notorious, where I really, this time, was in the middle of this triangle. And I felt for Ernie Bergman and I felt for Claude Rains. And I didn't like Cary Grant. And here in this case, I see where the characters are, but it's all for the fun of it. I there are so many great laughs and great, you know, set pieces and scenes, but everything seems somewhat glossy and funny and nice and a nice package. You want to see this at the cinema, but then you kind of forget about it right away. There's nothing that gets you involved really deeply with those characters because you've all seen it before, you know, down to the scene with the kissing. That's pretty much a take on the Notorious scene, but it's just much less dramatic. And of course, the mother being comedic this time, whereas in Notorious, she's really dark and manipulative. And it's almost like a satire of Hitchcock on himself, on his own characters at certain times. And that doesn't get me really involved. It gets me terribly entertained, but no more than that. How about you, Julie? Do you feel the same?
I think that what sort of always strikes me, and I love that movie, what always strikes me about North and Northwest is the imagery again. I mean, who could forget that airplane crashing into the truck? And who could forget Eva Marie Saint in her black dress with the red flowers and the ruby choker, right? These are some very still images. It's almost like a photo album. So in that sense, I agree with you. But I think seeing it again and again and again and again this time for the podcast, I think Eva Marie Saint as the rivet between all these characters is really quite a feat that she gets away with what she gets away with. So both funny and flirtatious and then brave. And then towards the end, it gets pretty dramatic as she realizes she's about to be killed and she has to make this long walk to the airplane and she's thinking about what to do. So in that sense, I can relate to someone like Eva Marie Saint's character, but most of it, of course, is just romantic proto-Bond fluff. It's wonderful the way it is, and it's perfect the way it is, but it's not very character-driven. That's absolutely right, yeah.
I mean, I would say it is character-driven in the sense that it's really, it's Cary Grant drives it, Eva Marie Saint drives it, James Mason. I mean, again, it's these icons that we talked about. I think all the characters, except for Eva Marie Saint, are one-dimensional, perhaps, but I also think they need to be one-dimensional. I sometimes call films like these Meringue. You know, they're kind of light and fluffy, and this, I think, is a perfect meringue, but there's pretty much no calories apart from the sugar. But there doesn't need to be. I think, you know, I mentioned earlier on that lots of people tried to imitate Hitchcock and very few managed. In that respect, North by Northwest, I always think of North by Northwest, and then I think of Charade, which I think in some ways does very much similar things, but it leans totally into that side, the meringue side, the fun, fluffy side. And I think in that respect, because it ignores the darkness that Hitchcock usually has, because it ignores the character complexity and just leans into the fun, it perhaps succeeds at copying one kind of Hitchcock much more than the ones that actually try to go for the darkness and don't get the balance right.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with that more, because it feels like this is the most honestly just entertaining movie. The word nihilism, I'm not sure if I pronounced it correctly, came to mind with this movie. It's kind of goes forward, you know, step by step and wild ride by wild ride, and then kind of erases everything that went on before. I was, you know, surprised this time to see Thornhill's secretary and in the first scene, and then, you know, he dictates all those things to her, and it's kind of a small characterization of all his Madison Avenue life that he has. She completely disappears, never comes back. Then there's his mother, who's important for the first third of the movie. She completely disappears afterwards. She's no longer important. And then there's all these exciting rides, these fun rides, but in a way it doesn't lead up to a round image of a character. He's more like a man, a stand-in, you know, the wrong man or the wrongfully accused who needs to clear his name. And of course his name, you know, itself, he's called Roger O. Thornhill, and the O stands for nothing.
Absolutely.
He says.
Yeah.
So in a way, it's kind of wiping out certain things, almost in an ironic way. It's basically about nothing, but it's terribly exciting and fun.
It's the Seinfeld of Hitchcock movies, yeah.
Yeah, but I also think that feeds into the wish fulfillment just briefly, because he gets to go on this grand adventure and he doesn't have to think about secretaries and mothers anymore. And he gets the girl in the end, and it's all awesome. I mean, I see that as complete wish fulfillment.
I mean, it's also, again, coming back to the, you know, history repeating itself, first as drama or tragedy, then as farce. If you think about how the two films end, and I think structurally there's a lot of similarity in the two films, but the scene that Notorious ends on in some ways is such a small scene. You know, it's basically four characters coming downstairs, one of them poisoned by two of the others, but it's essential that they basically get her out of the house. So it's a scene that dramatically is extremely tense and extremely small. The scene that North by Northwest ends on, apart from the joke, you know, the Freudian joke with the train going into the tunnel, it ends on one of the most spectacular final scenes in all of Hitchcock, the pursuit on Mount Rushmore, people falling down the faces of presidents or hanging from their noses like weird, iconic boogers. And a scene like the one that Notorious ends on would not have worked in North by Northwest at all, exactly because the characters by design are fluffy.
Yeah,
I don't think we would have bought into the drama. We wouldn't have bought into the smallness. You had to go big there, and it doesn't get much bigger than those big stone heads.
I also see kind of the sea change, you know, in his movies from the mid-40s, still under the impression of World War II, and kind of small Hollywood dramas made at the studio mostly. I mean, we talked about Rio before, you know, they never go to Rio. There's just like a couple of images at the beginning. And then in North by Northwest, almost the opposite, where he tries to take us on a travelogue of places, all of them iconic, grand and great in Technicolor, Vista Vision, and all these things to make it extra big. So it's almost like in 15 years, he was able to go from 1940s Hollywood drama and then create something completely different and grand. I don't know if it's a D or a T at the end. Are we ready to move on to Psycho already?
Absolutely. I mean, since we're talking about meringues, I mean, obviously Psycho is the next thing.
I don't know what you would call that, you know, in terms of a dessert or a sour grape, or I don't know.
Death by chocolate.
I was wondering about that because we now saw some similarities, sometimes strong similarities, even down to certain scenes between Notorious and North by Northwest. Of course, the style has changed and the focus has changed. Now, Psycho seems to be, I don't know, at first glance, at second glance, something completely different in Hitchcock's oeuvre. And I was then wondering about that, maybe later on, if you also felt the same or if there are still certain Hitchcock touches and elements that we can even compare to those two movies. But I was surprised by the fact that this movie, it was just the next one after North by Northwest. And it feels like a completely different animal in so many ways, even though some collaborators were the same. Herman also did the music for this one. But mostly he was relying on his television crew, because since the 1950s, he had been doing the Alfred Hitchcock Presents episodes, some of them by himself and then other directors as well. And now he uses most of these to do Psycho, based on a small but popular novel by Robert Bloch, basically a slasher story. And many people said he was inspired by, you know, Roger Corman and William Castle, those famous producers who were doing slasher movies at the time. And he wanted to do a slasher movie himself. And so he chose Psycho. And in so many ways, this feels like one of his TV episodes, if you watch it the first time. It's black and white, and it's, again, very studio-focused. Also, just the storyline follows this traditional TV episode build-up where you're not really deeply involved with the characters, but they seem to be in some kind of trouble, and then they try to solve their trouble by doing something radical. And then there tends to be a type of a reckoning at the end or a surprise ending. So in a way, Psycho is a blown up version of the TV episode. But at the same time, it's also something completely different. And I think has become something very, very iconic and influential for, I don't know how many thrillers and horror movies and directors who love doing them. I mean, Psycho is really the mother of so many things in movie history. So I was trying to see how characters work in the movie, because there are iconic characters in this movie as well, clearly. And what I found most striking is that how manipulated we are in this film by Hitchcock to root for all kinds of characters. But then at the end, and I was thinking about nihilism again, he wipes out our connection to these characters in different ways. So first of all, there's Marion Crane, this young woman who has a love affair with a married man, but they don't have the money, they don't have the possibilities to be together. So she tries to solve this by stealing $40,000 from her boss, or one of the business deals he's made. And she drives off, seems to be as a spontaneous decision, takes the money and wants to drive to her lover in a different city, but then gets into all kinds of trouble and seems very suspicious towards policemen and car salesmen, and then ends up at this motel, Bates Motel, tries to stay the night, meets Norman Bates, the owner of the motel, and sees that he's in trouble himself with his mother, who seems to be very domineering. And then they have this great conversation, or this strange conversation, where we get to know Norman Bates much more and the trap that he's in with his mother, who seems to be not doing too well mentally. And he's very touchy about the subject when Marion tries to talk to him about that. And then, of course, we have rooted for this character, Marion Crane, and she even decides to, after this conversation, to go back and take the money back and kind of redeem herself and try to get on with her life without all this guilt. And then, of course, famously, she gets killed in the shower by what we think is the mother. And then I think there's a great shift towards Norman Bates. He discovers the body of the young woman that his mother has killed. He cleans up, and we even want him to, you know, clean every trace up from the murder. And then he dumps the car in the marsh at the back of the motel. And we even want the car to sink. And we're somewhat completely on the side of Norman Bates suddenly. And we think he's the victim of this domineering mother. And we see the mother and hear her a couple of times. At the same time, there are a couple of detective characters, a real private investigator who goes after the missing person, Marion Crane. And then, of course, the sister, Lila, and Marion's lover, Sam, were also kind of substitute detective characters. I didn't find myself really rooting for them, but I was kind of taken along by their investigations. And they end up coming back to Bates Motel, the detective getting killed, and Lila and Sam trying to figure out what went on, what goes on with Norman and what has happened to Marion. And then, of course, again, famously, there's this big twist at the end where we realize there was no mother character. So it's, again, wiped out and Norman Bates isn't the one we should have rooted for. But then Hitchcock does a final thing and he wipes out Norman Bates' character altogether. And we're left with this strange, I don't know what it is, half creature who is the mother and who isn't the mother, who is Norman Bates and who isn't Norman Bates. And we're left with, I don't know, I felt completely shattered. And I think that's the feeling that many, even my students had at the end. You're completely shattered with nothing. There's nothingness at the end. We were manipulated and somewhat destroyed at the end in terms of our association with characters. Did you feel the same or similar?
Yes, of course. But I had a little detail that I just thought of that while you were explaining. Look how many birds there are in this movie. Marion Crane comes from Phoenix and she has this conversation with her would-be murderer between birds, stuffed birds. There are a lot of birds in this movie, so it's a nice precursor to Porcupine Hedron in The Birds.
Absolutely.
But yeah, but I think because he switches protagonists, so we think Marion Crane is our protagonist, then she's murdered. Now she's no longer our protagonist. Now we're left with nothing. Then, of course, we have Norman Bates. Now, suddenly he becomes the protagonist. So I think that's the trick that Hitchcock pulls, is that because he takes away our first protagonist, we sort of latch on to the next person that we see, which is Norman Bates. And then Norman Bates ends up being the bad guy. And it ends with this weird speech by a psychiatrist that's always thrown me, and it still does, rewatching it now. That's a very strange way to end it, with the consummation of Norman Bates by his mother persona, right? He's just eaten up as if by some giant spider. So that protagonist is taken from us as well. And there is no one really to take their place. The private detective is very interesting because at some point I did latch onto him. I was like, oh, he's going to maybe be the next one, right? Until he goes up the stairs and with his wonderful shot from high up gets pushed down the stairs. So I think that's why it feels so empty, because it keeps, our protagonist keeps being taken away from us, right? I think that's the trick.
I think it's also that, I mean, in some ways, I think Psycho is perfect pulp. The psychology is pop psychology. The characters, it's very broad strokes in some ways, but I think Hitchcock also has more modern characters and characterization here than he has, of course, in his earlier films. I think the whole question of, you know, who's good and who's bad in cinema at this time was starting to be less black and white, no pun intended. You can get more, you know, ambivalent characters. You can get characters who do bad things, but they're not bad as such. They're not evil. And I think you have that very much with Marion Crane. Again, I find it difficult to say how much this would have been the case for audiences at the time and whether they would have felt it the same as I do. But I think Marion Crane, she's sympathetic. You can identify with her. She makes a mistake. She does one stupid thing. You don't want her to get punished as such. It doesn't feel moralistic when she dies horribly. But then it's also in that respect, you know, just how we can kind of feel, we can identify with Marion Crane and then she's gone. We can identify with poor Norman Bates because he's a victim, or we get the impression he's a victim. Again, we don't see what he does. We might think, you know, don't do that. Go to the police. This is a way to get rid of your mother and all so on and so forth. But we feel for him in spite of him doing bad, horrible things. You know, if you look at Vertigo, for instance, where, as we've already said, you've got the Jimmy Stewart character who's ambivalent and sometimes quite horrible. It still feels different because we expect him to be a good guy. It's still the kind of cinema where you expect good guys and bad guys. But I think by 1960, you don't expect that kind of stark Manichaean good and evil anymore. So I think it's also easier to feel sympathy for a character who's sad. I mean, there's pathos to Norman Bates. As a footnote, perhaps, have either of you ever seen any of the Psycho sequels?
I have, many years ago. Yeah, I've seen them all. I don't remember them very well, apart from Anthony Perkins being there all the time, mm-hmm. and Vera Miles in Psycho 2.
Yeah.
But, I mean, definitely you could tell this wasn't the story that's supposed to be followed up on somehow. It's this nihilistic, shocking bit, and then it should be done. But apparently people were hugely fascinated with Psycho and the mansion, and you could visit it for the longest time. Maybe you still can on the Universal lot. So I think there was a need for sequels, but I don't think it was necessary at all.
Yeah. I mean, I think I watched Psycho 2 and Psycho 3 when I was a teenager. And I think everything after Psycho 2, you can just, I think, completely forget about it. But Psycho 2 has some interesting things it does with Norman Bates' character. It latches on to the pathos that is there and actually continues that. So I think it's not a great film. It's definitely, you know, no comparison to the original, but it picks up on some things in not uninteresting ways.
On a very similar note, have you watched Bates Motel? You know, the Netflix series that deals with Norman Bates' childhood and his relationship to his mother. Have you seen that at all?
No. I haven't, no.
I've only seen a couple of episodes, and it's always something I've been meaning to watch. But there's now like 4 seasons of that. So it's kind of the childhood story of Norman Bates and how his mother treated him. And of course, the things that are alluded to in Psycho, you know, his mother getting to motel and getting involved with a man who then dies horribly. And some of it seemed fascinating from what I saw. But I still believe Psycho should be just the 1 hour and 40 minutes of Hitchcock and that's it. It's so perfect in the way it's framed from beginning to end. And there doesn't need to be anything else, I think. Let's talk about the mother, because I called it the mother of all psycho thrillers. And we've mentioned that there's a mother character in each of the movies. And maybe as a more general question, we said that Psycho is so different from the other two movies. But did you also find parallels where we say this is really Hitchcockian, this is typical? And I thought one parallel, of course, was that there is a mother character. And one scene that I noticed in Notorious is that there's actually a conversation between Sebastian and his mother that could technically be a conversation between Norman Bates and his mother. The only difference is that the mother is still alive in his case. So that I definitely saw as a parallel element, maybe a character, a typical character that he puts in there. Did you also find other such parallels between Psycho and the other two movies?
Yeah, the tainted lady, right? So Bergman is an alcoholic and Marion Crane is larcenous. She's a thief. And they are both these beautiful blonde women. And they are both slightly tainted by what they are and what they have become for reasons, obviously. But this is something that you usually see in Hitchcock's oeuvre with the men, which happens, who are conflicted within themselves, blah, blah, blah. And these are two very specific women where that happens for the woman in the film, right? You see that in Vertigo too, though it's less focused on, but that's sort of the same duplicity, right? So that's another one. And of course, again, the images and the way, I think it was Saul Bass who storyboarded the really famous shower scene, but that kind of framing with where you see her dead face and the camera pans, right? It's that sort of imagery is just typical, I think, of Hitchcock. So that's just a couple of them, but I think there are more, right? Toilets, for one.
Yeah, exactly. It's apparently was the first toilet that was ever shown in a Hollywood film. It's
you can kill women.
It's amazing.
You can kill women quite graphically on screen, but you cannot show a toilet. But Hitchcock has a sort of obsession with toilet in North by Northwest too, where you keep seeing him in bathrooms shaving himself with a lady's razor. do you remember that? Yeah.
So yes, absolutely. Such a laugh.
There are toilets everywhere. This one is actually in the shot where he usually avoids them. But he has this thing about toilets and washrooms. So that's
one. That's very interesting. I've shown the scene to my students, asking them, you know, what do you think was the scandal in this scene? And of course, everyone says, well, it's the graphic murder. But in a way, it's the toilet being flushed.
Yeah.
So much for Hollywood conventions in the 60s.
I mean, one thing I would say about the mother in Psycho is that she is one of the most clearly evil characters. Of course, you have this question about, you know, does she exist? Does she not exist? If she's just in Norman Bates' head, does that make her real or not? But, I mean, we've talked about a lot of villainous characters, but I think we've all said that many of them are not clearly evil. If I think of evil in Psycho, in Hitchcock, I do think of the mother much more than Norman Bates. But then I think of, you know, Uncle Charlie in Shadow of a Doubt, Bob Rusk in Frenzy, Bruno Antony in Strangers on a Train. He does have purely evil characters. But it's funny how none of us latched on to films which have all that much in the way of clear evil villains.
Well, they're less interesting. Nothing like a bit of moral ambiguity, you know?
So looking at the three films, if we compare them and you look at all of them, was there a favorite moment that you had? Maybe as a final question, a moment that really stuck out for you where you said, this is quintessential Hitchcock, or this was my favorite moment. What would that have been in those three movies?
It's difficult, I think, to make a difference between favorite or most iconic. But for Notorious, for me, it's the staircase shot. This really long shot where you go all the way down into the party and then to her hand where she holds this key. One of the most, I think, most iconic Hitchcockian scenes in Notorious. But it's really hard to pick one.
What about you, Matt? Did you have a favorite scene that really stuck out for you?
That's like asking me to, you know, pick my most stylish child or something. I think I would have to say all of North by Northwest, the scene that starts with the beginning and ends with the ending. But there's so many scenes to choose from. And I think North by Northwest puts them all into a package that comes together magnificently. I find it almost impossible to pick one. But if I'm going to just have to pick one, I think it's just one line by James Mason, because I just love the way he delivers it. It's when he says, "Games, must we?"
All right, that's at the beginning when he's first captured at the mansion and James Mason walks in. Well, I feel the same, obviously. You know, those are three absolutely great movies, and just seeing them again was spectacular, I thought, just focusing on characters this time much more than in other viewings. I picked an obscure one from Psycho that I hadn't really remembered. I mean, it's not really one of the famous ones. It's towards the end when Marion's sister, Lila Crane, she goes into the house to look for Mrs. Bates. And then she ends up on the first floor and she enters the bedroom of the mother and then Norman Bates's childhood room. And there's the only two small moments in Psycho where I felt there's kind of a lyrical, sad moment where we feel kind of the tragedy of what has happened in his house. She walks in and there's all kinds of clothes and the imprints of the mother on the bed. And then she scares herself in the mirror. She goes into Norman Bates's room and there's all these toys and records and books. The music is also quite lyrical in that moment for the first time in the score. And I really felt, in terms of characterization, of feeling the tragedy that we then know what it is at the end. These two short moments really stuck out for me this time.
Okay, so now that we've finally dedicated one episode to Hitchcock, I think it's a good point to bring the episode to an end. Perhaps just briefly, I don't know about the two of you, but here in Switzerland, definitely, it seems like the lockdown is coming to an end, at least to some extent, and cinemas will open again. So is there anything that you're looking forward to culturally over the next month or so?
June.
Absolutely. June is just around the corner, and let's hope for lots of culture there. What about you, Sam?
Well, for me, the biggest lockdown effect was, of course, that the next Bond movie was postponed, and I was looking forward to so much to No Time to Die on the 2nd of April, and now it's going to be November, we hope. So that's what I'm looking forward to seeing at the cinema in a few months' time.
Cool, brilliant. So thank you both very much. Thank you very much, Sam, for having us talk about Hitchcock and some of his most fun films.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Julie. Thank you, listeners. And yes, we, as always, will be back in a month's time with more Damn Fine Cups of Culture. Till then, goodbye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.